Jimmy cracks corn and I don't care. It's time for the SAFTACast. I'm your host, Scott C. Now, those of you who are regular listeners to this program know I like to take a couple minutes at the start here, at the top of the show, to tell you a little about what's coming up with the Sundress Academy for the Arts, and this time is no different. I want to tell you about some of the upcoming SAFTA workshops that are happening in the next couple of months. This weekend, special guest Darren Demery is coming to the Firefly Farms to talk about writing love poems that are worth reading, to help you write love poems that avoid the cliches, because not all roses are red. Not all violets are blue. Most, if not all, sugars are sweet, though, so I'm not a biologist. I don't know squishy science, so I don't know exactly. I'm not a chemist. On October 11th, the SAFTA is bringing you My Other Car is Another World, Writing Fiction in the Genres, with special guests, author, poet, and scholar Gary Charles Wilkins will be there to talk about writing science fiction and writing in different genres. Then on November 1st, just a couple weeks later, Nicole Aquindo, famous author, is coming into town to talk about visual translations and hold a workshop on that. Now, I'm telling you about these three workshops, even though they're a ways off in advance, because right now, as you are listening to me speak these words, the Sundress Academy for the Arts is offering a special deal. You can get two workshops, your choice of these three workshops. You can choose two and attend both of them for the price of one. That's right, it's a buy one workshop, get one workshop resale, and it is going on right now. To get in on this action, be a part of both workshops that you want to be a part of, all you have to do is go to the Sundress Publications store at sundresspublications.com and click store at the top of the page. All the information is there. Now, I know I talk a lot about the Sundress Academy for the Arts, and maybe you're not familiar with it. Maybe this is your first time listening. That's cool. Welcome to the program. Nice to meet you. I'm Scott C. But I talk about it for a good reason. You know, I'm proud to be a part of it. They do a lot of great work, and they help a lot of artists of all different levels and all different styles. And now you can be part of it. The Sundress Academy for the Arts is now accepting short-term residency applications for writers, filmmakers, visual artists, composers. If you are one of those people, or you know somebody who is one of those people, and maybe you or they are looking for a cool place to live and work on your art, whatever it may be, then check out the SAFTA website at sundresspublications.com/SAFTA, S-A-F-T-A, and then click on Apply. I would love to be able to tell you all about the Sundress Academy for the Arts and all the amenities that are there and much, much more. There's just a lot to tell you about, and you can get all that information on the website. I'm not just trying to get links to the clicks to the website. No, we have a podcast to get to, but trust me, there's a lot of information, and I encourage you to check this out. Again, check the SAFTA website at sundresspublications.com/SAFTA and look at Apply. You will find all your informational needs are taken care of there, and tell other people about it. Yeah, I'm telling you right now, I know for a fact, because I'm in on things, that applications have been rolling in, but there is still time to submit one yourself and hang out with a bunch of cool people. Speaking of cool people, today's show features the one and the only Leslie LaChance, and it was a great pleasure to chat with her again. It had been a while since we had last chatted together, and it was a great little conversation we had. We explored many of our own childhood traumas, but also the joys of our childhoods. We both grew up in upstate New York and have a lot to discuss about that, among many other things. So get ready, strap yourselves in. This is a great one. Nashville, the Hudson Valley, and much, much more with Leslie LaChance. Hit the theme song, won't you? Leslie!
Hey, Scott! Hey. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm fabulous.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. Oh, wait, my camera. There's my camera. Okay.
Oh, that's better. No need for visual. I don't have it queued up on my end. So
okay.
Just makes it more of a hassle to do that. So
okay.
So I'm going to start it off with the burning question that is on everybody's mind right now.
Okay.
Okay, of the four original Beatles, who would you most want to wrestle?
Wrestling? Well, I think Ringo would probably be the most fun to wrestle.
You know, I would go with Ringo myself.
You would?
Yeah.
Something about that beard.
I think it's just that he had a lot to prove.
Yeah, and and as a drummer, he had all that upper body strength, you know, so it would be a real challenge.
Be a good fight.
Mm-hmm, I think so.
I think he's got to get the anger out from being shafted by the other Beatles.
Ringo doesn't strike me as the kind of guy, though, that would hold a grudge.
Maybe not. Paul, yeah. Yes.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. So what you been up to lately?
Well, I just arrived home from a little gathering of lady poets here in Nashville. I'm a member of the Lucille Clifton Collective, and we meet one Saturday a month. And we do, we write together and we talk together and we plan and scheme together. And it's a lot of fun. So I just rolled in from that.
Nashville doesn't strike me as a place of poetry hotbed.
You know, and that would be a surprising thing to learn about Nashville is that there's lots and lots of great poetry going on here. We've got some independent publishers working here, and pretty much you can go to a poetry event, I would say 5 nights a week, you could find something going on in Nashville that involves spoken word, poetry, book signings. It's pretty amazing. And then in October, the second weekend of October, we have the Southern Festival of Books every year. And so there's always lots of buzz around that too. And yeah, there's actually a lot going on.
Yeah, it just wouldn't strike me, being that it's the hotbed of country music and everything. It seems like other arts would get put to the side.
It seems like that would be the case, but I think the music industry over the decades has attracted all kinds of creative people to Nashville, not just country music artists and the people who prey on them.
But, sycophants.
But all kinds of artists. And so there's actually a pretty interesting art gallery scene here. I mean, you know, it's not Manhattan or San Francisco or Chicago, but Nashville's got an interesting scene, and a couple of sort of museum quality venues that are very good. So I think that's the first thing people think about when they think about Nashville is sort of they think of it as this country music monolith. But there's a lot more under that.
Does that extend to not just the arts, but just in general? I mean, what's the deal with Nashville then?
So I think the deal with Nashville is that it's also a town that is sort of coming into its own as not only an alternative music scene, but an alternative arts scene. And interestingly enough, it's getting a lot of attention as a foodie kind of town. Periodically articles will show up, you know, like in the New York Times about all of these great places to eat in Nashville. And so I think it's definitely a growing city. And there's a lot of optimism here about that. I mean, people grouse and grumble all the time about what's wrong with their city and what needs to be fixed and what needs to improve. But I think generally people are pretty, pretty interested in I don't know, seeing what they can try out in Nashville. There's a new organization that has opened its doors this past year called Oz, and they're bringing in some interesting programming. Like this weekend, they have A Midsummer Night's Dream being performed by the actor Tim Robbins has a theater group in LA called the Actors Gang. And so the Actors Gang is here at Oz from LA doing Midsummer Night's Dream. And it was last night and tonight. So pretty cool stuff.
That does sound pretty cool. I know that Nashville's gotten expensive over the last few years. The prices have just gone up because I've had friends there for many years. I'm saying.
Yeah. Real estate has really changed. We bought a house here 5 years ago when the market had dropped a little bit. But since then, yeah, it's a lot of real estate has really gained in value, and I think it's just because there's a lot of interest in the creative arts scene here. But I think it also attracts a lot of people who are in, I don't know, healthcare. There's a big healthcare industry here, So, and then a number of universities. So I think that's part of it too.
Bloody hipsters.
I know.
They first took Brooklyn, now they're coming to Nashville.
Well, and you know what's really funny is that I meet people here who are sort of Brooklyn refugees. You know, they've moved to Nashville because other cities have become so unaffordable that, relatively speaking, Nashville is a lot more affordable than certainly Brooklyn or even Chicago and places like that.
And they're going to jack up the prices in Nashville now.
Yeah. You'll be a little appalled.
Exactly. Well, there was talk, I remember reading something about possibly destroying Printer's Row down there.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering what's going to happen with that. It's definitely a historic area of the city, but it's really something that attracts tourists. I don't think we see, you know, a lot of locals doing stuff there, although, you know, locals work there, of course. So I don't know. We'll see what happens with it.
Not going to argue with the tourist money, but
Yeah.
So what would be the good local places to go then? Oh, or maybe we shouldn't say that because now our listeners will be like, "Oh, when I go to Nashville, I got to
Yeah.
go there."
Well, I have to be honest and say that I'm, you know, kind of a devoted resident of East Nashville, and we started coming here maybe a little over a decade ago. My husband's daughter was living here and working in the restaurant business over here, and we started hanging out at a place that's still a really great place to go hear music. It's a tiny place called Family Wash, and it's called Family Wash because it was a laundromat, and then it became a pub, and they just decided not to change the name. And it's a live music venue, but the musicians, there's no cover. The musicians just play for tips. And they have pub food, you know, beer and wine, and then things like shepherd's pie and that kind of stuff. But the best thing about it is it's sort of like an extended it for a lot of people who live in East Nashville who care about that kind of thing, it's kind of like an extended living room, you know, because it's a small venue and it's really friendly. But really incredible musicians will play there. A lot of people who work with super famous artists in their touring bands when they're not touring will come and play. It's really kind of a musician's bar. And so we've seen a lot of great people perform there over the years. And I would say that we're probably there like once a week. And then in East Nashville, there's another neighborhood called Five Points, and there are a bunch of little clubs down there where it's great to go hear music and some good places to eat. So that's a good neighborhood to hang out in.
One thing I like about the Nashville music scene is that you can run into, if you know your country music and such, you can run into some of the best sidemen who are on the recordings. And, it's like, we're not even talking about people like Willie Nelson's band, Mickey Raphael and such, who have names, but we're talking like obscure, yeah, I played bass on this Waylon Jennings album.
Exactly. And you know, the other thing about it is that these working musicians are our neighbors. You know, that people in Nashville live around all of these working musicians, and you know, they'll see them out of a Sunday cutting the grass. In their, you know, little craftsman cottage front yard.
It's almost like they come to the city and they, when the music career kind of fades and everything, they're like, you know what? This is a nice little town. I'm going to just stay here.
Yeah, well, and they continue to get work too. You know, they'll do session work or they'll tour, you know. And I think people start to realize that you can make a living doing what you love, playing music or whatever it is that you do. And you might not get rich and famous, but you can have a nice place to live in a good town with access to lots of great resources, cultural resources and educational resources for your kids and all of that sort of stuff. So I think the quality of life kind of attracts people to the city as well and keeps them here. So it's one of the things I really dig about it. And I sound like an ambassador for my, you know, adopted city, but it is really how I feel. I love living here.
Well, you say adopted. Where were you originally from?
I was raised in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York.
Ah, the Hudson.
Yeah, in mid-Hudson Valley, a little town called Saugerties. Most famous because of its proximity to Woodstock, I think. But yeah, so I grew up there, and it was actually a pretty rural slash suburban existence, you know.
How so?
Well, it was a small town. But when you say you're from New York, people think automatically New York City. We were like, 100 miles or so from New York City, a little over 100 miles. So you had the effects of New York sort of reaching northward, and that was where you went to do important things like, your school field trips would be to New York City, and you'd go to the important museums, and you'd maybe go see a Broadway show or go to a Yankees game, sort of the destination city, But where we lived in the Hudson Valley, it was just very, surrounded by farms and apple orchards and things like that. And it's in the foothills of the Catskills as well. So you just have the Catskills sort of hulking off to the west there. And that's, very rural and
Yep.
very Appalachian.
Well, the Catskills are basically New York City's version of the Adirondacks.
Maybe so, maybe so.
Because I've been deep in the Adirondacks a couple times, and that is real hillbilly country in places.
Yeah, I think the Adirondacks, they're higher mountains than the Catskills, but I think that that's a pretty, you have to be a pretty hardy winter survivor to live in the Adirondacks.
Yeah, I grew up in Binghamton, so I was right on the
Oh,
Pennsylvania
yeah.
border.
Okay.
So I totally understand everything you're saying. New York
Sure.
City was our destination city.
Right.
We
But
go to.
Binghamton too. I mean, that's a southern tier city, and that's I guess technically kind of a rust belt city, yeah?
It was ranked in 2012 as the most depressed city in all of America
Awesome.
and the least
Awesome for Binghamton.
optimistic.
Yeah.
We earned that dual award that year.
Yeah, that's some serious snow belt territory, Binghamton.
Not terribly. Syracuse to the north, about an hour,
A little
is
bit worse.
worse. Much worse. But I totally understand what you're talking about up there. Probably got the channels from New York City. I know that in Binghamton we got WPIX, WWOR out of New
Yes.
York.
Yes. Channel 5, Metro Media Television. Yes, we had all our TV out of New York City and Albany.
And
Yeah.
Boston, for some reason, we had WBSK out of Boston.
Huh, interesting.
I don't know how we got that one, Channel 13, but.
Oh,
But no, I'm also familiar with the Hudson. Half my family is from Albany, so.
no kidding.
Or
Yeah, that's
Schenectady,
my
so.
dad's side of the family is from there, and my mom went to school there, so.
Yeah, well, Schenectady, actually, but. Same. I consider it the whole capital region. Doesn't matter. Schenectady, Scotia, Rotterdam,
Yeah,
Troy, it's all there.
it's all of a piece.
It's all one giant piece up there. So that was the other destination city for us kids.
Yeah, us too.
Sixth grade, it's like, okay, we're going to go visit the state legislature today.
Exactly. And there's a state museum in Albany too. I remember going to that. And I remember going to see plays at the Egg.
Oh, the egg.
Yeah, so it was cool. Cool place to go.
So how'd you wind up in Nashville then?
Oh, well, I like to say it was a long series of mishaps, but I was actually in a relationship with somebody who was heading for graduate school at Vanderbilt, and I was working lots of different part-time jobs in New York at the time as an adjunct and freelance writer, and I thought, well, I could work lots of part-time jobs anywhere. And so I moved to Nashville, and that was in 1990. And it's really funny what happened. I moved to Nashville fully expecting I would just be hustling up all kinds of part-time work. And so I had sent out some applications, and one of them was Volunteer State Community College, which is just up the road in Gallatin. And they called me 2 days before I was leaving and said, "Could you be in for an interview on Monday?" And I said, "Oh, well, okay." So I think left town on Friday, got to Nashville on Saturday, got a place to live on Sunday. I had an interview on Monday, and they said, "Can you come to work tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, okay." So I spent a year teaching at Volunteer State while I was applying for PhD programs. And I got into a few different schools, but the program that really fit sort of best with what I wanted to do was in Knoxville. So I ended up going to UT Knoxville, and I was in Knoxville for 11 years. And then I ended up getting a job at UT Martin, which is where the man who became my husband was working, and I ended up moving into the western part. So I've now lived in all three grand divisions of Tennessee. Lived and taught in Martin for a dozen years, but decided that I really we'd been coming to Nashville so much to be with my husband's daughter. So we just sort of fell in love with the city. And when my husband retired, we decided to move here. And of all things, I'm back teaching now full time at Volunteer State.
Full circle.
So it's kind of a fun story, but.
No, it is. I can't argue. Every time I've gone to Tennessee, I've always had a good time. Doesn't matter where I go. Doesn't matter who I see. I just love the state.
Yeah, well, all the SAFTA people in Oak Ridge and Knoxville are great fun to be around.
I've been going there since 2003. I went to Memphis then, had a great time. Although Beale Street is very touristy and such.
Yes.
I was the perfect age. I was like 24 or so, and I just had a great time.
Yeah.
Love Chattanooga. It's got a great aquarium. Love Knoxville. I have yet to find a place in Tennessee that I just dislike.
Well, every city in Tennessee has its own personality. There's something that makes each town really distinctive. And that's what I like about it.
It's not like Iowa. Nothing slamming on Iowa, but Iowa's just this state.
You know. I've driven through it. I think maybe I camped overnight there one time on a cross-country road trip.
Are there any states that you absolutely despise going to?
You know, I want to be really polite and say that every state has got to have something going for it.
Let's be honest, though. There are some states where you're just like, oh, no, I really don't want to deal with them.
I don't want to write any state off in its entirety, but... I don't tend to go to Florida a lot.
Hey, I'm not offended. I'm not offended.
And driving across Arkansas, like Arkansas has Little Rock and Little Rock is cool, but
Hot Springs is beautiful.
And Hot Springs, yes. But driving across the state when you're on your way to somewhere else is kind of torture. I don't know why.
No, I totally understand. Texas is similar, but Arkansas, I went to Memphis and the bridge across the river, I swear, Memphis is a giant city. You go across it and immediately it's tidal flatland and nothing.
Absolutely.
You know, Arkansas.
West Memphis is true.
The one state I've never been to and I don't really want to go to is Wyoming.
Oh, now I have been to Wyoming.
I refused for many years to even accept that it was a state, because when was the last time you heard of something coming out of Wyoming?
Yeah. Well,
it just doesn't exist. It's like a territory. It's there.
It's pretty dramatic. I mean, I drove across it from west to east. I was coming back from a road trip to see my sister in Reno, and there were lots of oil pumping things happening in Wyoming in part of the state. And then as you kind of hunch up on, and so you don't, there are no trees, you know, it's just prairie, 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 prairie. And then these oil rigs, you know, coming up out of the prairie for miles and miles and miles. And then you finally get to eastern Wyoming, and that's where the hills start to pick up as it hunches up on South Dakota there. And I remember just getting, after hours and hours of driving through endless prairie, and that's not a landscape that I do well in, you know, big flat landscape like that, getting to where there were hills and just stopping the car and breathing and being so grateful to see hills again and pine trees. So that's my Wyoming experience.
All I know is that it exists and that it's got a town or two, and that's all I can think of.
Yeah, and national park.
National parks. It's got beautiful landscape, but I can't think of anything else. I can't think of famous people from Wyoming or anything.
Dick Cheney.
Again, I can't think of famous people coming out of Wyoming. But no, I understand. Florida is the same way. It's very dull driving sometimes in Florida because it's just flat land.
Yeah, a lot of it. Now, I was in Tallahassee a couple of years ago, I guess maybe now, for a yoga workshop, and I liked Tallahassee pretty well. Of course, I was hanging out with yogis, so that might have had something to do with it.
Maybe it depends on the company you're with. There are some nice places. I won't argue. I like Key West a lot. It's beautiful. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Orlando?
Not so much.
I could take it or leave it, depending on what I'm doing there. Miami, I won't go to.
No.
It's just gigantic, and it's busy, and it's hot, and it's just... it's not my type of place to be in.
Yeah, I've heard mixed things about it.
I'm sure there are good stuff there, but Yeah, I've been near it driving, sometimes traveling southbound, and yeah, it's nightmarish.
It looks a little bit intimidating.
There are some Sanibel Island on the West Coast. I really love Sanibel and that area.
Yeah.
Fort Myers. Beautiful.
Yeah, I've heard good things about that. And also some people tell me that St. Augustine is really nice because it's got some historic architecture kind of stuff.
St. Augustine is a great small town. I lived there when I first got married. And it's a beautiful small little town, but it's so spread out. So if you're working in Jacksonville but living in St. Augustine, that's a 50-minute commute.
Wow.
So it's pretty brutal.
Huh. That's interesting. I'll tell you what, one of the things that we could do better in this country is mass transportation. It's my little obsession.
There's a big fight in Florida right now about putting in a high-speed rail system down here.
Oh, yeah.
And there are a lot of people in favor of it, but there's a vehement opposition to it. And I'm not really, I can't speak too much to it because I have only been following it indirectly as it's come up in other stories. But you're right. The country infrastructure is kind of messed up as it is.
Yeah, but I mean, do you really want to spend half your life sitting in traffic? You know, I have a 20-minute commute now to my job, and 25 minutes really. And I'm going the opposite way of traffic. So I'm leaving the city as everybody's driving in. And so I see, you know, the interstate looking like a parking lot as I'm leaving town. And I just think, gosh, I'm so lucky to not have to sit in that traffic. But I also know that as the population density increases in Tennessee, it's not going to matter which way you're going on the interstate after a certain point. You know,
no, especially if we keep touting local places to go to and such.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't know what to do about that, but I also happen to really like driving. So I understand, you know, I understand why people love their cars. I love my car.
Oh, I love road trips. I just love, I don't mind traveling, you know, by car for 16 hours. I love it.
So where's your favorite place to road trip?
It depends. It really depends on where we're going. I mean, there are certain places in this country I love more than others just for, I will never abandon my upstate New York roots. Can't do it.
Yeah, me neither. I go back probably twice a year.
I go back maybe once a year, no matter how many times I'm like, I'm not going back. I hate it.
Well, maybe we need to carpool sometime.
Maybe. I only go up to see family now because every one of my good friends has gone from that city now. Virtually everybody.
From Binghamton?
Yeah, there's nothing there for me anymore.
Mm.
And there's a few restaurants and places I used to hang out that still exist, but beyond that.
Did you go to school in Binghamton too?
Yep. I was there for the first 29, 30 years of my life.
Wow. Yeah, I lived in the Hudson Valley till my mid-20s.
It's very hard to leave a city like that.
Well, and I think when you have family and your roots are there, you know. And it's funny, when I first moved to Tennessee to come to Nashville, I believed that it would be temporary. And I think I always imagined myself eventually moving back to upstate New York. And the longer I stayed, the more the kudzu vines grew up over me here in Tennessee. And the more I started to realize, you know, I don't really think I'm going to need to go back to upstate New York. I mean, my family is there and I do go to see them. And I do have friends there and I've maintained those friendships. And they're very much rooted there. And I have a few other relatives. So, I mean, and I have reasons to go. And it's, the Hudson Valley is so absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's one of the, you understand when you're there and you watch how the light just comes down through the clouds over the Catskills or over the Hudson River, and you just see that light, you know why Thomas Cole painted there. You know why Frederick Church painted there. You know why Asher Durand painted there. The landscape is just stunning. And you can even see it when they, you know, when they painted on other subjects, European subjects or classical subjects, they incorporated that same kind of chiaroscuro Hudson Valley light. You can see it in their paintings. You're like, okay, that might be a painting of Greece, ancient Greece, but that sky, that's the Hudson Valley sky they put over that Grecian temple, you
That
know?
is not ancient Troy. That is Troy, New York.
Exactly. And so you can just see how the landscape was so affecting, right, in their work. So I think I hope I'll have occasion to be in the Hudson Valley a lot in the coming years. I'm trying to kind of arrange my life so that I can have longer stays there in the summer. Typically, like I'll go for just a week or 10 days, and it's all that very hurried visiting, you know? And I thought, well, now that I'm kind of settling into a grown-up teaching job where I could actually know what my summer schedule is going to be, maybe, you know, maybe I could spend 4 weeks in the Hudson Valley. So I managed to do that this summer. I was up there for about a month, 3.5 weeks. And I just thought, yeah, I could probably do this every year. I could transplant myself. I don't know that I would do it in the winter.
Reverse snowbird, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Buy a little summer cottage up there in the Hudson Valley, camp,
Yeah,
whatever.
exactly. Well, you know, and I'm actually considering, you know, living my life out of an Airstream at some point, so it would work out really well.
There you go. Get an Airstream trailer in the next couple of years and then just haul up there for the summer
Yeah,
and come back.
I'm so interested in that tiny house movement. Do you ever read those tiny house blogs?
Yeah, I've been seeing those.
I'm thinking, oh, simplify, 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 tiny house, get one on wheels. I could totally do that. I could see myself doing that.
I envy it in a way because I could do it. I really don't own that much stuff that's necessary. But I'm also one of those people that just, I have stuff and it never leaves.
Well, and I had to confront that too, you know. I mean, I actually have a piano. I'm sitting right next to a piano, and I just don't think a tiny house would have room. It's not a big piano, it's just a little spinet, you know, but it's still a piano, which is a pretty substantial piece of furniture.
I mean, I'm not a hoarder or anything. It's just that things arrive and then they never go away.
Well, and you know, and then there are books, right? I mean, it's I find it I do the book purge, you know, now and then every few years, but then, you know, for as many as I get rid of, twice as many seem to appear on my shelves.
I love my wife, but she will not do a book purge ever. We did one when we merged our libraries together and we went through and okay, we both have a copy of this book. Which one's the better one? Okay, you got the hardcover of this. Okay, we'll keep this one. This has got the better looking cover. We'll keep that.
You have to do that with music too.
Oh no. That's where I draw my line.
Oh no, no purging of the CDs, no
Oh
purging
no.
of the vinyl. Are you a vinyl guy?
Not as much as I used to be.
Yeah.
I still have one milk crate back in New York that I keep of specific ones that I won't get rid of. Nothing that's, I'm not a collector or anything. They're not worth that much. I think the most expensive one I have is maybe worth $15 on the market.
Oh, well, you know. You keep them because you love them.
Exactly. I really want to hook up my computer to them sometime and digitize a few of them that you just can't find anymore.
Right?
Michael Jackson reading the book of E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
No, really.
Yep. I got that when I was like 5. My parents shoved E.T. on me and I was frightened to death of the thing.
Oh, I bet.
And they just shoved him on me and I freaked out, but I never got rid of that album.
Oh my gosh, I was in maybe my first year of college when E.T. came out, but I remember seeing it, right? And it had been marketed, you know, as a children's movie, and I remember seeing it thinking, "Oh my God, children would be traumatized by this." It was terrifying, you know, when you think about that, especially the men in the white suits and all of that. Oh my gosh.
When I finally saw the film when it first came out on VHS, I think my parents found a buck, and that was the first time I saw the film. I was so happy when he died. I cheered. Then comes the funniest scene in the movie for me is when he wakes up out of his death coma and he's trying to talk and they zip up the bag on him and he's still talking.
I see that and I'll giggle like a maniac, just him going, meh, meh, meh. Then they open the bag and he goes, meh, and then they close it again. I fall apart laughing every time. But
it was a strange movie. And I was working in a t-shirt store in a shopping mall at the time. One of those stores where you know, has all the iron-on decals. I don't know if you remember those days.
Oh, yes.
Or the iron-on letters. Yeah.
So. Start with that felt like plastic vinyl, but weren't, and they had sparkles all over them.
Yeah, and you had these books of decals that you would press on the t-shirts,
yep.
You know, and I cannot tell you how much E.T. crap we sold. It made me not want to see the movie because we had, of course, all the merchandise like before the movie even came out.
There was a lot of merchandise.
Yeah.
But Spielberg kind of got dark for a time. I mean, you had Close Encounters, then E.T., then he does Poltergeist.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because everybody kind of thinks of him as this happy, fuzzy guy, but that's also the man who brought you Schindler's List, you know? And, you know, when that came out, he was interviewed and said a lot of the sort of pop films he'd done, in a way, financed that because that's what he had been working toward was that film.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
But no, E.T. frightened the heck out of me. I still remember I had a bumper sticker that I picked up somewhere. Because as kids, we love stickers. We're obsessed with them.
Of course.
And I got some bumper sticker, and I remember it vividly. It was bright neon green, and it just said, "Beep if you love E.T." I could never figure out what that meant exactly.
Yeah.
Honk, yes. Beep? Yeah, I don't know.
No, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Have you ever been a big bumper sticker person for your cars?
You know what? I have a couple of tiny window stickers. I have one that's the flag of Spain, because I've been several times and love it. And I have one that is Amsterdam, the flag of Amsterdam, which is a fabulous city. And then I have a little window sticker promoting my daughter's yoga studio where she teaches. So...
You gotta have that.
Yeah, but no, bumper stickers, not so much.
Not a big thing. You prefer to keep the car pure.
Well, you know, I have a Mini Cooper. I think you saw my Mini Cooper.
I did this summer.
Yes, yep. And I love this car because it's the cutest car ever. It's like driving a go-kart, and I don't feel like she really needs a lot of decoration. She makes people smile just the way she is, you know?
Like so. A classic VW bug makes people smile.
Exactly. Exactly. So they don't need to really be accessorized.
I understand what you're saying. I have a RAV4 and I feel like that needs accessories because there's so many of them and they're just kind of there.
How would you accessorize a RAV4?
Well, every side of it now has some decal on it. So the front license plate is the symbol of the Rebel Alliance from Star Wars.
Okay.
And the back side windows and the passenger side are my fraternity symbol. And then on the back end is a bumper sticker from another podcast. I can find my car, though, in any parking lot at any angle.
See, that now the Mini, because she's so short, sometimes I can't find her right away, you know, and she hides. And I have in my mind this kind of wish that the Mini would come equipped with something that would allow her to sort of jump up and say, I'm here, if I whistled.
Like if you hold the remote and you're like, car, where are you? I'm right here, Leslie.
Yeah, well, and if she could just jump up, you know, and wave her antenna at me.
Here's an idea then, all right?
Okay.
When you park in a large parking lot,
mm-hmm.
carry a Nazi flag. Put it in your window. When you come back out, there will be so many protesters around the car, you'll have no problem finding it.
Oh, poor Minnie. She could never, ever, even though she is actually technically a distant cousin to a BMW, she just could never. I heard a funny story, though, about, I'm going to get this wrong, but I'm going to try and tell it anyway, about they were manufacturing Minis in Oxford, England, yes. As part of it, they had designed a particular kind of robotic arm that could lift the entire frame of the Mini and place it I don't know, on the line to be assembled. And the guy who had created this robotic arm, it was like a mobile robotic arm on a mobile platform. And the story was that at night, he was going around the little town of Oxford while people were sleeping and picking up their small cars and moving them places. So with it to test the robotic arm that was going to be used in the mini factory.
And just to be a jerk.
Could you imagine coming out and finding your tiny little British car not there, but across the street from where you left it? He didn't put it where they couldn't find it. You know, he would just like move it like a few cars down or on the other side of the street or, you know.
And then they try to arrest him. No, I was just testing this giant robotic arm.
Yeah.
Almost like a supervillain in a way. No, I was just testing my giant robotic arm.
Yes. And I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know if that is just an urban legend, but I'm going to repeat it anyway because I find it quite amusing.
We'll just say it, it's a fact because it's a good story. What made you go with the Mini Cooper? I'm curious.
I just out of curiosity, we were driving by the dealership one day and I'd been seeing them and I thought they were incredibly cute. And so we drove by the dealership and I actually wasn't even thinking about buying a new car, but just for fun. I will do that sometimes. I'll just like pop into a dealership car deal. I love cars. So I'll pop into a car dealership and say, I'd like to drive the such and such, you know, and I have no intention of buying one. And that was kind of the case with the Mini Cooper too. I was just like, I just want to drive one of those. They're so cute. Well, I drove one and I thought, okay, I think I'm going to buy a car. And so I bought one, but I didn't buy one off the lot because they didn't actually have what I wanted. So I had to order it. And when you order it, it takes 6 weeks for them to bring it to you. And because it has to come from England, you know, on a boat, they give you a little code and you can get on the website, the Mini website, and you can track the progress of your Mini. And it will tell you where it is in the supply chain. And so it'll say things like, your Mini is poolside on the ship, you know, having a martini.
Okay, that's cute.
It's really cute.
It's better than just currently in transit.
Yes, exactly. So they make up this little narrative for all the things your Mini Cooper is up to on its way to you.
They can enhance that, I think, with maybe photographs. You know, they can shoot photographs of just a Cooper sitting on the Lido deck or something.
And then marketing, yeah?
Yeah, it'd be great marketing. And then just change, you know, have it so you can change the color for whoever the person is. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Mess with it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that leads me to a question then. Okay. You say you're a car person. Mm-hmm. If money was no object, what is your dream car?
I really love Maseratis and Ferraris. I love temperamental Italian things. So perhaps some sort of a Maserati or some sort of a Ferrari. But I'm also really intrigued by the Tesla. I'm very interested. See, for me, when it comes to cars, performance is really paramount for me. And I know that's not in a very politically or environmentally correct thing to say. I try very hard to be a good environmental citizen, but when it comes to a car, if it doesn't go, I'm just not really interested. I'm sorry. And I love the idea of the Prius. I think it's ugly and slow, and I have no interest in a Prius. A Tesla, on the other hand, is a prospect because it is a high performance automobile that also is environmentally perhaps a good choice.
Wasn't it like, I think it was a few years ago, Hyundai came out and basically said, look, we did it. We made an actual roadster that's electric. And I know they tested it on Top Gear and said, this is what it's going to be.
Right. It can be done. Exactly. And so I would actually consider a car like that, provided, you know, it had a speedometer that was respectable.
I'd like to gun it every now and then.
Exactly. You know, when you're pulling out into traffic, you just need that little extra.
You know, you don't want 0 to 60 in 20 seconds.
No. It needs to be much quicker and 60, hell.
So what got you into cars in the first place?
I don't know. You know, I think it's something left over from my adolescence. I just was around people growing up who cared about cars, who constantly worked on cars, and I just maintained an interest ever since. Part of it, there was a period where I actually thought I might become a mechanic. And I took some classes, and I had this whole idea about, you know, being able to build a car yourself and being able to at least do all the, you know, repairs that you could possibly do. And so for a long time, I bought sort of junker cars that needed lots of love and attention, and I learned how to work on them and could do some things. But over the years, I have prized a little bit more reliability as I've gotten older. But I don't know what, I don't know. Just something, I maybe that's what makes me so American, you know, and just kind of hung up on this freedom to just jump in the automobile and go wherever you want very quickly.
I'll say you have the American ethos, but not the American car
Well,
idea,
yeah,
because
it's true. Styling wise, I really do tend to prefer designs that come from other places. I'm not sure why that is either, but
American muscle cars, I like Top Gear's assessment of them. They look pretty, they sound nice, but they only go in a straight line.
this is true. This is definitely true. And I do, I mean, you know, I like the Mustang. I like the Camaro. You know, I do. I like the Corvette. It's just, you know, they're just not as much fun to drive.
Because American muscle cars, they don't understand handling.
This is true. There's something a little bulky and sloppy about them.
It
Kind
has
of
to.
like our culture altogether. A little bulky, a little sloppy. A
Think that's a great book title right there. A
little
little
bulky, a little
bulky, a little
sloppy.
sloppy. Essays on love and being an American.
I
There you
think it
go.
could be an anthology.
Ooh, that would be a good one, you know? It could be the new Love American style. A little bulky, a little sloppy. And we'll just do little vignettes about romantic stories like Love American style, you know, with stupid jokes and punchlines.
Involving muscle cars.
Involving cars, involving fast food restaurants, whatever you want.
Exactly.
Two people finding love at a burger shop, you know.
Over the onion rings.
Yep, a little bulky, a little sloppy. There you go.
Onion rings and O-rings. There we go.
Ooh, that's a good title too. I'll give that one to you. You can take that one.
Onion rings and O-rings. It'll be
Yeah.
one of the pieces in the anthology.
There you go. You can take that one. I'll give that one to
All right.
What was your first car now? I'm curious.
My
'Cause no one
first,
forgets their first car.
yeah. Well, my first car that I bought for myself was a VW Bug.
Original?
It was a 72 VW Bug, yes.
Nice.
And I bought it because I could work on it myself, because it truly was a people's car. So yeah, that was my first.
Was it firsthand or secondhand?
Oh, it was probably fourth hand. It was quite old, but it was a sweet little car, and I drove it for a long time.
I've long had it, and it started out as a project between my father and I, but we've just never gotten to it. We have an original 63 Volkswagen Bug.
Oh, that doesn't even have backup lights, or maybe it does. Maybe
It
the
does,
63. That one
yes.
does, but they're still tiny, right?
It's
The tail
early,
lights.
yeah, it's early 60s, I want to say. It was my mother's first car. So,
Nice. And it probably still had just the pure chrome bumper without any rubber on it.
She bought it in Germany when she was over there visiting Denmark and family, and had it shipped to America, and we still have the hull of it and a lot of original parts, but we've just never sat down together and rebuilt it.
That's a worthwhile project, though.
Yeah. I'd hate to say that probably one day I'll just sell it to a collector and have them rebuild it. Yeah, because I just don't know when I'm going to get the time.
Oh, I know. And it is, it's a, you know, you have to make the commitment to it. I had a friend who rebuilt a 1960 Volkswagen.
Oof.
And for a while, he didn't have any place to store it. The engine lived in my bedroom. It
That's a great conversation piece when you bring someone to your
was quite
bedroom.
interesting. Yes, it came to live in my bedroom. I have pictures of it on the floor.
It's great. You know, you bring someone over to the house, to the bedroom, like, and like,
yes,
oh,
here are my books, and here's my friend's Volkswagen engine.
Coming to the bedroom, expecting one thing, and just, you know, step around the carburetor there. It's okay.
Yep. No worries.
I've been wanting for a while now to go to a junkyard and get a couple seats out of a car and make them into office chairs in my house.
You know, it would give it that clubhouse kind of feeling if you did that.
And they'd be very comfortable.
Most likely.
Got the idea from watching Top Gear, and they did that with their set, is to use car seating, and the table is an engine with a glass top.
I have seen that set. That's a really adorable show.
My wife and I got into it a few years ago on a news report from 60 Minutes, and happened to be streaming on Netflix. We watched a few episodes, and before we knew it, we were watching the whole series.
Yeah. They have adventurous spirits, I think.
The news segment is always my favorite, because that is not scripted, really.
Right.
And I could tell that they are not expecting some of the things they say on each other, so...
It is. It's adorable. Part of it is also the improvisational nature of what they do. You know, when they're in their travels and things happen and they kind of have to improvise repairs or, you know, how to get unstuck from something or all of that kind of stuff. So I really like the sort of problem solving improvising that they find themselves doing.
I'm probably now going to go after this interview, watch a few episodes, you know.
I might have to as well.
Like the truck driving one of my favorites.
Oh, I don't know if I know that one.
That's a good one where they decide to become truck drivers.
Oh, for a day. Like semi.
Yeah.
Oh,
lorry drivers.
Lorry drivers, exactly.
There's one other one I love is where they pretend to be 17-year-old boys and try and get cars on their parents' insurance. And see if they can pull it off for like 3,000 pounds.
Yes.
It leads to some of my favorite comic moments on the show.
It is. It's hilarious.
I think the episode that made me fall in love with it was the road trip from Miami to New Orleans.
I don't think I saw that one either. No, I need to catch up, apparently.
Most of it's on Netflix at this point.
Yes, I dabble. I dabble in the television now and then, but not to a great extent. I would like to be able to watch more, but you know what? Things just get away from me.
I find as I get older, I have less tolerance for crap.
Yes, or at least we're more selective in the kind of crap we tolerate.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's only so much I could take.
Well, and you know, you just think, well, and at my back.
When I was 20, I would have probably been all over Twilight and everything, watching it, ironically. Now, I'm not even going to waste my time.
Oh, you know, and I felt a little bad about that because so many of my students were reading that, you know, and also now the 50 Shades of Grey, you know. So I, you know, one of the things I do is I ask when I'm teaching, I ask my students about their reading habits. And, you know, I mean, a lot of them do not read anything at all, right? But the ones who do read stuff like that, and I think I really should know what that is. Never mind. No.
I'll read the synopsis on Wikipedia. Yeah. I'm fine.
Yeah, exactly.
So, what else is on your mind?
What else is on my mind?
Yeah. That's a loaded question, I know, but...
I know. Well, I am... looking out my window into my backyard and noticing that the grass really needs to be cut. So that's on my mind.
Just the minutiae of the fall.
Exactly. And the temperature has dropped a little bit to more comfortable range.
I wish I knew what that felt like here in South Florida.
I know. I'm sure it's still beastly by you, but it's starting to actually ease up here in Tennessee. So that's been nice.
I find, correct me if I'm wrong, okay, from upstate New York, it always happened within a week of Labor Day.
Oh, yeah.
Within a week, almost dead on. Labor Day was there, and then boom.
Started to get a little chilly, but that's not the case in Tennessee. It's a little slower, and you know, there's something about fall and spring in Tennessee that I really like, because they are more leisurely seasons here than in New York, right? So, I mean, fall was glorious in New York, but it was over like that, you know? It's like all of a sudden everything was on fire and beautiful, and then it was done, you know? And in Tennessee, fall kind of takes its time, and you don't get so much bright orange and bright red in the foliage. You get a lot of gold, you know, and it's a little bit more of a leisurely pace, and there are still leaves on the tree even into November, whereas in New York, by Halloween, you were done. Then it was cold.
Yeah, there's about a two-week space in there in early to mid-October.
That's it. That's the height. Like Columbus weekend is awesome in New York.
I think what makes Tennessee appealing is that you get all four seasons, but they never outstay their welcome.
This is true, although sometimes winter can feel a little long.
But you're from New York.
Yeah.
It ain't winter.
No, it's true. It's not. It's not really.
It's winter light.
Yes, it is.
Well, of course, this past year, you guys had that terrible, terrible cold snap in January.
Incredible. Just incredible.
Yeah, I left visiting up there. I was visiting for the holidays. I left just before that dropped, and it was 0 degrees.
Wow.
So, part of me was glad to get back to Florida, where our temperature at that time was like 60-something.
That's right. I was a little envious.
You can be envious then, but...
Not in the summer, though. I don't envy you the flow.
Yeah, wait until the heaters kick on in March and don't end for about 9 months.
Yeah.
We got 3 month reprieve, that's it. There's something wonderful about walking outside at 7 in the morning and it's already 81 degrees and 98% humidity.
Yeah. You just have to spend a lot of time. If you're outside, you just have to spend that time outside being really still.
Mm-hmm. And move only to drink water. I go to class in the summer and I bring a sweater with me.
This is true in Tennessee as well. I find the air conditioning quite aggressive.
You go into class, 20 minutes later, you're like, why did I bring a sweater with me?
Exactly.
30 minutes later, you're like, oh, that's why.
Yeah.
We've covered a lot of stuff already here.
Cars and food and traveling and states we don't like and Beatles.
Oh, I know what I wanted to mention real quick is back to cars for a second.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned that you have the Spain and Amsterdam on your car.
Yes.
So, and you mentioned something about Spain being like one of your favorite places.
I love Spain.
How often do you get across the pond to there?
Well, I try to go someplace across the pond probably about every 2 years is what I can afford in terms of money and time. And so I've been to Spain twice. I have friends in Amsterdam. My husband and I have folks that we're close to who live in Amsterdam, so sometimes we'll just go and see them. And I also have family in Italy, so I've been through Italy a few times. But last time I was in Spain was not this summer, but the summer before. Marilyn Callett, who directs the creative writing program at UT Knoxville, does a summer program in Auvillar, France, which is outside of Toulouse. It's a one-week writing workshop, and I was able to get some funding and able to attend this writing workshop. It's called O Taste and See, Writing the Senses in Deep France. That summer, that May, I got to go, and it was so close to the Spanish border that we just decided to pop over into Spain. So we flew down to Madrid, spent a few days in Madrid, and then went up to Bilbao. And did the whole Basque country thing and went to Pamplona and San Sebastian and all of those wonderful places. And that was great. That was some serious tapas eating. But they don't call them tapas there. They call them pinchos. And so you eat these pinchos and they're like, you walk into these bars and they're like these sculptures, these beautiful food sculptures. With all kinds of delicious things on them, all kinds of fish and ham and delicious things, cheeses, olives, sardines, everything. So good.
Something you brought up earlier as well, and I'm taking it just the way you were talking about it. Do you have much of an art history background?
No, any art history I have is completely self-taught. I have no academic training in art history at all, but I love to look at art, and so... Wherever I go, wherever I'm traveling, I try to go and look at art museums. And I'm actually one of those people who reads the stuff. I look at the paintings and the sculptures and the photographs, but I actually, you know, read the little plaques and stuff and try to learn things that way. So my art history is spotty and I guess also kind of improvisational. But I do. I go to see art often.
So you're a self-taught art historian then?
Well, I wouldn't even, like, I would, no. Historian would just be a hyperbolic description of what I am. But I love to look at it and I love learning about it. And I love learning about the artists and the process. And
do you do much yourself?
I don't really. A little bit of collage work, a little bit of photography, but I do write ekphrastic poems in response to art. So that's something I care about a lot. And I like reading ekphrastic poems and it sends me to the artwork. So that it is, it's an interest of mine.
What is the appeal of visual art? I'm not saying, you know, I'm not being dumb about that. No, understand?
Yeah, no,
but
no.
What is the appeal of it to you?
It's a good question. I think it's about attention, you know, and we talk about this in writing too, right? How what makes a piece of writing interesting to us is that it focuses our attention on something that we might not otherwise pay attention to. And I think art does that for me, even abstract art, you know, it makes me pay attention to the relationship between shape and color and space and thought. And then the less abstract stuff and the more representational stuff makes me pay attention to scene and detail that I might otherwise just pass by, you know, texture and just the rhythm of space and how it's used in the piece.
Is there any particular school of art that, you know, you just obsess with?
I think maybe not so much, but I do spend a lot of time looking at photographs, I think, in terms of a genre. And I like photography a whole lot. And, you know, I mean, who's not a sucker for the Impressionists, right? And I don't know, maybe it's because I've also sort of had this sustained interest in fantasy landscapes. I tend to like what I see in the Pre-Raphaelites. And then, of course, the Hudson River School, because that's what I grew up. I grew up in that landscape. So those guys.
You just look at the pictures and you're right back home.
Mm-hmm.
That depth.
Very much so. There's a famous painting by Thomas Cole of the Catterskill Falls, which is just a little north of my hometown. And you can go to the Catterskill Falls and they still, to this day, look exactly like that painting.
Whew.
It's still a wild place.
I might have to pay a visit up there on my next trip up.
Yeah. Get in touch. We could do the Hudson Valley.
I try, you know, try to split it. Go up there for Thanksgiving or Christmas and then split it. Other family, you know, split off and on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, we'll go to New York for Christmas this year. We'll go for Thanksgiving next year. That
right.
sort of thing.
Yep. That's how we do it too.
Unless there's some event that happens in the summer that I need to be there for.
Well, you know.
You know, weddings, that sort of thing. Now, I've kind of made my bed down in Florida now.
Well, you know, I've been, I wouldn't say I'd been great about keeping in touch with people I went to high school with, but Facebook has sort of changed that and has put me in touch with people that I never thought I would still be in touch with. Now there's discussion of a 30th class reunion. I almost fell over when I saw that notice going out. 30th. My 30th high school. I haven't gone to any of my high school reunions.
I went to my 10th. And my 20th is coming up.
Yeah.
And I'm not going. I've started drafting an essay actually about why I'm not going to go to my 20th year reunion.
And why are you not?
There's no point. Facebook does the job now. It solved everything.
No. You cannot make social media a substitute. It should only be a means.
I'll be honest. I wasn't the most popular kid in my high school class. When it boils down to, I can answer everything in a note card, basically. I send them a 3x5 card to everyone saying, all right, are you married? Yes, no. Do you have children? Yes, no. What is your occupation? What is your spouse's occupation, if applicable? Are you currently dead? Once I've asked those questions, there's nothing else to talk about between us.
Well, you don't know, you know, you just don't know. I'm surprised sometimes. People I never thought that I would talk to suddenly we find we have something to say to each other. So I wouldn't write them off. I too was not one of those people who, I don't know, was a stellar socialite in high school, you know. But it's funny because I've actually thought, I've run into a few people since I've been home, you know, on and off, and found myself in these conversations about their lives and thinking to myself, well, you've actually had a really interesting life. And who knew you'd ever be so interesting?
I don't know. For some, Leslie, the scars don't heal.
No, of course not.
For some, we sit up at 1 a.m. staring at various Facebook profiles and going, you have a better life than me. I hate you for this.
Well, I don't know. I'm grateful for my portion anyway. I know some people have a bigger one.
Yeah, you know, I've worked hard to get to this point. Even in my head, the boys didn't win.
Well, yeah,
I've won by enjoying my life anyway. Yeah, you know, they didn't stop me. I mean, look at this. I get to chat with awesome writers almost every week.
I know.
For fun.
What a fun thing to do, right?
It's a great thing to do,
right? Like Pichos in Spain,
or E.T. There's got to be a couple poems in me about hating E.T.
I hope so.
The childhood trauma of E.T.
I think it was a very traumatic film for children.
I should write a whole act. I could probably fill a book with all of my childhood traumas.
Oh, you know, that's been done, though. Not yours in particular, but...
It's been done, but I never had anything traumatic.
Oh,
you know, like
oh,
there was,
so it would be a work of fiction.
It would be like, there's no divorces, there's no death, there's no... sexual abuse or physical, there's nothing.
Yeah.
I had a clean childhood, so the traumas would all be pop culture based. E.T. Yeah. scared me. That's a whole series right there.
Yeah.
The first time I went and got a haircut.
Yeah. So haircuts, right? That's a big thing for people. But here's the funny thing. When I was a little kid, my dad is an entrepreneur, but a small businessman. So he's never been like a big corporate guy, right? So he's an entrepreneur. And the first business I remember my dad having was he had a hair salon, not a barbershop, a hair salon. And I think he had a hair salon because people who had salons made more money than barbers or something. But he didn't go to barbering school. He went to hair salon school. And so the only person to cut my hair for years and years and years was my dad. So getting my hair cut was never traumatic. I was spoiled.
My first haircut, the barber apparently had broken his nose a couple days before. So here I am, this like 3-year-old, having his hair cut by a 70-something old man with a broken nose.
Ooh, and black eyes probably if his nose was broken.
So I think there's a book in there of my stupid childhood traumas.
Yeah. So. No, I was very lucky when it came to the hair thing.
You were. I will envy you on that one.
Mm-hmm. It's still really hard for me to let strangers cut my hair. I still want my dad to do it. Yeah.
We are running out of time here. We're almost at the time here, and I want to make sure that we get to other important things real quick.
Oh, like literary things?
Yeah, like we gotta be good here as part of the podcast regulations, so to speak.
Okay.
So, what do you got in the works right now? What's coming down the pike?
Oh, so I have a couple of exciting things. Tonight I'm actually gonna go out to a poetry event in Nashville, one of the many. There's an open mic tonight, going to that. But on Tuesday, this coming week, I am going to be the featured poet at East Side Storytelling. There's a wonderful guy named Chuck Beard who runs a small bookshop here in East Nashville called East Side Story. And he promotes local writers. His whole focus is promoting Nashville writers. And so that's his specialty. And two Tuesdays a month, he does an event called East Side Storytelling. And he features a local writer and then a local musician or band. And it's about an hour. The show lasts about an hour. And he does a podcast of it. So I'm really honored to be the featured writer this Tuesday. So that's my very soon upcoming thing. And then in October, Aaron Smith of SAFTA fame is going to come down for the Southern Festival of Books. And we're going to do a panel with a couple of other writers and community arts organizers on creative collaboration and organizing arts events in communities based around literature and writing practice. So that's coming up second weekend in October. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah. So how can the listeners at home find you on the net?
You know, I had a webpage and I don't anymore. Which is maybe a terrible thing, but I am on Facebook. I also edit Mixatini Matrix, a journal of creative collaboration, which is an online journal. And so, they can find that at mixatinimatrix.org, and see all kinds of interesting, creative collaborations. We do two issues a year. So we have our spring summer one up, and we're going to be working on our next issue, which we will probably have out in, I don't know, probably December, fall, winter. Yeah.
We'll have to keep our eyes open for it.
Yeah. So I invite people to check out Mixatini Matrix.
Well, definitely. Leslie, it has been great having you on the podcast. I'm glad we finally got the chance to do it.
Yeah. And I hope I get to see you live and in person again before too long, Scott.
Oh, I hope so too. I should really plan a trip up to Nashville for next year, at the very least. I got unfinished business up there, basically.
Well, you come on. Yeah, I got a guest room, so.
There's a couple friends I haven't seen in a while there that I really should get back in touch with and explore the city with.
Yeah, well, come on. We'll show you all the cool places.
Oh, I know some of the cool places, trust me. I've had some wild nights down in Nash Vegas.
It can happen.
I have been down on Printer's Row in... I have been in Tootsie's Bar and Grill.
Oh, well, you know, Tootsie's is a famous place.
And Reuters, a little burger joint there is great.
Rotier's,
excuse me.
Rotier's, best milkshake in Asheville.
One of the best burger joints I've ever been to.
Yeah, it's pretty fabulous.
Small little joint, but worth the effort.
Oh,
so, yeah,
yes.
I will let you know if I'm going to be in the greater Nashville area.
Please do.
I will drop by to see you. Leslie, it has been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon.
The SAFTA Cast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit saftacast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.